Monday, and that means it's time for NFTN Radio, the show that helps developers find what they're looking for. Good code, good conversation, but most of all, good time. So here to bring us into the week is our host, Mike Benkovich.
All right. Hey, thank you, Eric, and I want to welcome everyone back to another week of NFTN Radio. This is the radio show that helps you know what's going on and what's exciting and what's interesting about developer technologies. We bring in experts who you can ask your questions by going out and dialing in to the live number. If you want to participate in the show, register for the show that you're interested in by going out to tinyurl.com/msdnradio- and then the show number is going to get us in there. This week we've got Joe Stagner coming on. It's an exciting week. We've got a lot going on today, right now, at this very moment, is the launch of Visual Studio 2010. A lot of good stuff coming out with that release of the product, all the way from the SharePoint developer pieces to working with websites to working with Silverlight and Rhea services, just all kinds of goodness that we're going to have to talk about today. If you're interested in finding out more about this show and other ones that are coming up, go out to the URL, msdnradio.com, and then the links to upcoming shows are going to be listed there. Plus, you can download the show after the fact at the Channel 9, and we provide those links as well. So let's kind of dive into what else is going on this week. We have a lot of interesting things with webcasts going on. We've got GeekSpeak. We've got the MSDN radio going on today, and with that, go out to benkotips.com and check out my blog if you're interested in seeing what's going on there. Today we've got on our show Joe Stagner, who comes to us from kind of on the east side of the United States there. Joe, are you ready for the show?
You bet.
So
here in sunny northern New England today, so I'm actually not in Vegas with the whole crew.
Yeah, Vegas sounds like a warm place to be. Definitely some hot things going on right there right now. Joe has been with Microsoft for quite some time. When I started doing the MSDN events, Joe was on the Microsoft Cross America team with me. And you started out doing a lot with the developer security, working with the Digital Black Belt Security webcast series, didn't you?
I did. So, yeah, back in the early days, so I started with Microsoft in 2001, and we had shortly thereafter, we had a bad year with a big SQL bug and a big IIS bug, and so nobody was really focusing on providing developers with guidance. You know, it's always easy to blame the base software, but you know, a lot of the software defects that that are security related are simply coding practices. I mean, folks can't know what they don't know. So I did the Digital Black Belt series for quite a while and had a lot of fun and got a ton of email.
Yeah, what was the number one exploit that people had trouble with?
Well, I think SQL injection was the biggest one because SQL injection defense was wired into any of the code by default, and then the second biggest was in web applications, cross-site scripting.
Sure. Well, the cross-site scripting, I think, has become more to the forefront in SQL injection that we kind of take for granted that people are using either stored procedures or with link, they're at least using parameterized queries that will help minimize that.
Yeah, although so that's true in terms of when they use code generation tools that are built into Visual Studio. They get some of that defense by default. But, folks sometimes still forget that, when you're writing all of the code manually, you can still introduce those sorts of defects. And SQL injection in particular is really scary because frequently folks don't harden the boxes that they run on. They don't harden the SQL Server instance itself. And then, one little exploit and, your whole network is sort of owned. But you're right. I think that, that a newer one is cross-site scripting. The prevalence of cross-site scripting has increased. And one of the scary things about cross-site scripting is that often cross-site scripting attacks, they sort of leverage somewhat non-savvy computer users. So, it's a tough thing to determine, when a browser is making a request on behalf of a user and it's a natural request, or when the browser is making a request on behalf of a user, but it's a malicious request, and it's hard to figure out how to differentiate between the two.
Yeah. Well, the ASP included the tag so that it would check the length of the request coming in. That helped a little bit. It sounds like there's a new syntax for doing, it's an open parentheses question or percent and then colon to do HTML encode automatically.
We've made HTML encode a little easier to get to, that helps a little bit. But I think more and more developers are sort of getting the hang of, adding that sort of coding to their thought process.
Sure.
It's not a new technology thing, but it's more the bad guys are getting more and more savvy. And it's interesting that there's historically we've thought of hackers as, sort of pimply kids in their basement who, want to deface a website for bragging rights. And that's not who the hacker is today. And the bad guy hacker is a professional criminal, probably part of some sort of an organized crime operation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going after monetary gain, no two ways about it.
So it's a matter of trying to figure out how they can take advantage of the information they're stealing.
Oh, absolutely. It's about, stealing information that has monetary value. It's about, stealing products and services directly or actually stealing money directly. I think the biggest advantage that we have as software developers is that there's just a much higher sense of awareness, and there are, a lot of best practices out there, education to show folks how to write secure code, how to defend, how to monitor their web application and record information that provides them with data that has forensic value if something does get attacked.
Mm-hmm. I know you did a bunch of stuff with the security, but you also did some stuff with the PHP and other technologies running on .NET. There's anti-cross-site scripting library that's available. Is that something that can be used beyond just the confines of what .NET has?
The one Microsoft produces is .NET focused. It's for it's for ASP.NET applications, but there are similar libraries that are available for other web development technologies. And it's there's no sort of magic bullet per web server platform or per web app development stack. It's just a matter of of implementing the security the security features in the code. So there are libraries no matter what your back end technology is, but
mm-hmm. Well, let's go to current. You've been working a lot more. I know that you started up the video series, the How Do I videos, in the ASP.NET site. Tell me a little bit about what your goals are with that.
Oh, wow! So Simon Muzio, who owned the ASP.NET site,
mm-hmm.
and I want to say about 4 years ago now, came up with this idea that there was a need for a new style of content, and that folks wanted concise, sort of not marketing oriented, no PowerPoints. They wanted concise, video based. How do I accomplish a specific atomic task? And so we started doing those. I think the first year, back then the DevDiv community team was just me. Simon was the manager, and I was the geek. But I think that first year, my videos had like 8 million downloads.
Mm-hmm.
And of course now the team has grown a lot, and we've got folks that are focusing on different specific technologies. Like we've got Jesse, who's all focused on Silverlight.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Pete Brown, who's doing all client stuff, WCF and web forms, and we just brought Ray Bangle on board, who's focusing on client side technology scripting, and so we've really rounded it out. For me, I'm moving the content that I'm doing. So I just came off a wave of I did about 40 quick hit feature videos for some of the new stuff that's in Visual Studio 2010 and ASP.NET 4, and then I spent a bunch of time. This isn't on the web yet, but I rewrote the iBuySpy
mm-hmm.
Application using a modern approach, still web forms development, but using a more modern approach, and that's going to there's a bunch of content that's going to come out of that will go on the ASP.NET website soon.
Oh, that'll be great.
And now I'm focused on sort of a new wave of content that is, I'm referring to it as curriculum-based, but it's, you know, sort of, I want to start soup to nuts, and I'm doing sort of three things. I'm doing some ASP.NET MVC content, and, you know, I've been really vocal in the last year that, you know, MVC is not replacing web forms. There's nothing wrong with web forms. I don't care what the, you know, what the alpha geeks say. Web forms has served us fine, and it's going to continue to do that. And if you look at the stuff that we announced as released today in ASP.NET 4, you know, there's really been an evolution towards the way that we develop web applications in the 4.0 version. However, there is a segment of the ASP.NET community that wants to do MVC-style programming.
Mm-hmm.
And I found, looking at the materials that we've generated, I found the learning curve to be relatively high. A lot of the feature videos and even the how do I stuff has a what I call an and poof quality to it, which means that I show you some stuff and poof, there's the result. And there are a lot of folks that don't learn well that way. So I started a series where I'm starting right with the basics and doing things I'm publishing this week, things like a Hello World in MVC with a comparison between web forms and ASP.NET MVC. And then another one where we build a contact form, and I'm doing that at a low level where we demonstrate not just, you know, here's how you generate some code, but here's how the request comes in, and here's how it gets mapped to the view that we're creating, and here's how we decide whether or not it's a strongly typed view or not a typed view. So hopefully, you know, that will build on an entire curriculum so that when somebody watches the whole series, they'll be able to say, you know, even though they thought that MVC was complicated when they first took a look at it, they'll be able to do the video series, follow the whole curriculum, and go, yep, I got it.
Well, that's great.
And I'm also working on another set of materials on this, a super secret project I can't tell you about that will be of great interest to ASP.NET developers and web developers using any technology.
And it's going to be coming out in good time, huh?
Well, it's going to be you'll be seeing it later this year-ish.
Ah, well, that's exciting. Hey, we've got some one of the great things about this show is that we have a bank of phones that you can call in and ask your questions. And right now I've got Paul Civetti. Paul down in Dassel, Minnesota, who's got a question for you. I'm going to move him into here so we can ask it. And,
okay.
Paul, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey.
Hi, Paul. Hey, Joe. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. Doing great. Hey, by the way, thanks for doing the kind of how do I series. Those things are very helpful.
Thanks. Glad to hear it.
That's always a good thing. I do have a question, which is in today's modern world, you know, in the age of proxy agents like Fiddler and Firebug, where you can basically see all the nitty-gritty going on behind the scenes. Do you have any suggestions or best practices for securing RESTful web services from unauthorized users, whether these calls are coming in from client-side AJAX or coming in from the server side?
Well, that's a great question. So one of the things to really determine up front is what does authorization mean, and what are you trying to defend? So lots of folks just like turn on all kinds of protection when it's not really necessary. But if is what you're referring to, you offer a service, a REST published service available that you want to restrict access to that service to only authorized customers. Is that what you're asking?
That's exactly right.
Well, so authentication doesn't change by virtue of being a REST service, right? So you can still require authentication before the service is accessed, and if there's no authentication token in place, you can you can deny to respond, or you can respond with some sort of a message. The more difficult problem to solve is how do you keep unauthenticated users from just pounding away trying to authenticate?
Right. Well, and actually, this specific case I'm talking about is in a syndicated data model.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something where we provide an authentication token, basically, to people who subscribe to the syndicated service.
Okay.
Okay. And the token doesn't really change, and that's part of the headache here.
So if somebody hijacks the token.
That's right.
Oh. Okay.
Exactly.
So one of the things you'll need to do is figure out what sort of mechanism your business model will support. So are those requests coming from a particular IP subnet at a customer, for example, when you can target IP addresses?
No, unfortunately, it's just when you get a syndicated model, it's going out kind of indirectly through to a very wide range. It literally could be nationwide.
So what you can do, Paul, is in the client, you need to create something that's got the network credentials that can come in and then basically provide the HTTP request with like a token, an identity token. If you've got that information, you can pass that across with the request. The URL that you're actually requesting it from can be put into a secure directory. So, for instance, you can put in the web config, like, hey, I want to lock down this particular URL to whatever it needs to be, and then basically just put your service into that folder that has that secured authorization, and then only allow those roles the rights to get to the particular part of the service.
Yeah, so Mike's right that simply having a token that doesn't change is going to be difficult for you to secure. If there's a static token, here's a number, pass it in the header of your request, and you're authorized, it's pretty tough to secure against that. So definitely one of the ways that you can mitigate that is to provide an authentication mechanism, an authentication challenge, as Mike is suggesting. There are other things. If you really can't do that, there are other things that you can do. But again, it depends on your app. I mean, can you use a certificate? If not, can you implement some sort of a single-time authentication where you then start to issue use once or timeout-based tokens? But a lot of how you actually do that will depend on what you can and can't do in your application. But hey, if you want to pop me an email at joe.stagner@microsoft.com,
okay,
we can set up time to have a phone chat and figure out what would work for your app.
Outstanding. Thank you.
You're welcome. And that would work, yeah. And that's a great way to get answers is to send us questions and send us email too. Because if you go out to the links for this, you'll find that we've got our emails out there too. Hey, Joe. Now, one of the other things that kind of is along the same lines is you have the AJAX libraries where you're doing the partial postback. You're getting information by through the XML HTTP request. The same kind of security would apply there as well if you're going for RESTful data, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So there's nothing new. So this is your question is a great segue because one of the sort of soapboxes that I've been on recently is that it's all just HTTP, right? So no matter what we're doing, all of this stuff runs on top of a World Wide Web infrastructure. And the level closest to us is HTTP, but we, as ASP.NET developers in particular, we've sort of either forgotten or lots of us never even had to learn about the gook that runs the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you are building your apps in web forms or MVC or something else, or whether you're making a full page request or a RESTful call or a SOAP services call, it's all just HTTP. And so if we dig down a little bit and understand a little bit about that request and response mechanism, what starts to become evident to us is that there are basic principles that apply across all of these different application models. So an HTTP request, there are a fixed number of ways that authentication can be implemented. Now, one of the things that we do with most web frameworks is to add some sort of an authentication model on top of that, and that means that we're either running on secure HTTP or not, and then in those HTTP requests, we're either passing some sort of security-related tokens or not.
Mm-hmm.
But that's standard, so it's not new. There's nothing super new about securing a REST API. The question is, how does your REST API security work in conjunction with the security of the apps that consume it?
Right. Well, and security works in a lot of different ways, and it's the back end, it's the front end, and it's security by defense in depth.
Yeah. So if you need you know, if you need security implemented in your REST-based API, does your application already have authentication in place that can be used for that REST service? Now, in the case of the fellow we just spoke with, it sounds like his applications don't pre-authenticate, but he wants to restrict access to the REST API by virtue of some authentication mechanism, and that's why it's a little bit more tricky.
Sure. Hey, let's shift gears a little bit. We've got Visual Studio launching today, and I know that there's a lot of interesting new capabilities in the editor. When you take a look at Visual Studio, what gets you excited?
Wow. So Visual Studio 2010, I've been running it since early builds, and there's, you know, some of the stuff that you would want, you know, sort of almost assume.
Mm-hmm.
Improved performance, much better IntelliSense. For me, particularly as a web developer, you know, there's improved IntelliSense for JavaScript, which is super important. I'm doing more and more client-side coding. There's great IntelliSense for cascading style sheets, and I've plunged headlong into cascading style sheets, not just for aesthetics, but I find myself implementing lots of behaviors in cascading style sheets as well. And that, you know, that code is portable across applications. I can share it with people, and they can put it in whatever app they're working on. But the biggest thing, so in Visual Studio, I mean, you know, there are just so many cool sort of new features that are things that are, you know, maybe, you know, there isn't a single sort of gee whiz type thing, but there's just a lot of little stuff that improves the speed with which I can write code. The biggest thing in the Dev 10 wave that I'm excited about, though, is the new rendering mechanisms in ASP.NET.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things that sparked all of this, you know, all of this conversation about, you know, web forms versus MVC was that the controls in ASP.NET web forms generated a lot of unfriendly markup.
Like tables and things like that?
Like tables and you know, yeah, if you wanted to do CSS stuff on some controls, you had to use the CSS-friendly adapters. And you know, a lot of folks think, or the more vocal sort of, you know, not Microsoft-friendly folks go, oh, that was just Microsoft blew it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, web forms was pure genius because it was released in a time frame where there weren't a lot of professional web developers, but all of a sudden it was a big hurry to get your apps to the web.
Sure.
So it took the model that traditional client-server developers, which we had, you know, hundreds of thousands of, you know, Visual Basic, Delphi, Power Builder, it took the model that we already knew how to use as traditional client-server developers, and it implemented in a web development tool set. It was genius.
Yeah.
And we didn't care about writing JavaScript code. In fact, we didn't want to learn JavaScript, and we didn't want to learn how HTTP worked. Right? So WebForms solved that problem brilliantly. Well, as web developers, we've evolved. So the thing that, to me, that's really exciting about this new rendering stuff in ASP.NET is that everything is geared towards being Web 2.0-ish. You know,
right.
That means, you know, that's such a, you know, such a cloudy term now. But, you know, it generates minimalist markup. It's CSS-based, not tables-based. And we have control over what gets generated. So we can say, you know, we want the old compatibility mode or we want, you know, the new way. We can also say things like, hey, we still want to use server-side controls, but I want to specify the client IDs, or I want to use a predictable client ID pattern so that when a control gets iterated by my ASP.NET web forms code, I can access it through my algorithmic logic written in JavaScript for the client using, you know, jQuery or the Ajax control toolkit or whatever I want. That gives us the best of both worlds. We get the developer productivity of using a controls and events-based development paradigm, but the flexibility to use as much, you know, tightly integrated client-side stuff as we want and not constantly be bumping our head against,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of the legacy markup issues.
Yeah, but doesn't that kind of get away from, you know, where we used to have the code mangler in Visual Studio when you'd switch between the code and the design view? Now they're going to make it so you can even find your controls with JavaScript?
Well, yeah.
All right, what's that all about?
Well, so, it's exactly the point that that as web developers, the expectations of our user interface have really changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really need to be writing client-side code. You know, and some of this is Ajax-style behavior, and when I say Ajax in this context, I mean, you know, in the sense of updating the content in the browser without making full-page postback, so doing,
mm-hmm.
you know, XML HTTP requests for something, so REST, POX, whatever, and updating the browser. We've sort of had to evolve, and it looked like, before we set on this path of sort of modernizing web forms, it looked like that evolution was going to force us to use something like ASP.NET MVC.
Yeah.
And you know, MVC is very cool, don't get me wrong. But I think that, you know, there are two toolboxes, and they're both filled with great tools, but some folks are going to gravitate one way, and some folks are going to gravitate the other way.
Would it be fair to say that the dynamic data pieces that we've been talking about lately, that fits more into the web forms than the MVC? Because it seems like it's almost a parallel kind of a, you know, where I can go out and I can use templated, you know, basically when you go out and you build a web application, you've got your list, your detail, your edits forms, your delete forms, all those different pages that you'd end up creating, you know, four pages per table, essentially. And dynamic data gives you templates so you can kind of design it once and then have that apply to all the different tables. And then in the .NET 4 world, they enable the dynamic data capabilities in the web forms. Can you still consume using a web forms approach from the MVC model?
You can. So let's talk a little bit about dynamic data. So one of the first things I'll tell folks is that there's a new version of dynamic data that's coming. It's not in the box with Visual Studio 2010 that's being announced as we speak, but it's coming very quickly. And you're right. So I think folks have a tendency to look at the scaffolding generation in dynamic data and think that's what dynamic data is. The scaffolding generation is just like a widget of convenience from my perspective. The real power in dynamic data is the ability to use these templates where I can define, you know, when somebody inputs a phone number, for example, this is what I want it to look like and this is how I want it to behave everywhere. And then if I change that, I make that change in my dynamic data template for that field type, and poof, it's instantly permeated throughout my entire application. And that can be really powerful, especially, you know, as web developers know, I used to work for a guy who said, we live in internet time where a year is 3 months long, right? So, you know, every web developer has, you know, had regular experiences where a boss walks into your office and say, hey, you know that thing you did yesterday that looks like this? Now I want it to be like this. Can that be done by the end of the day today? And, you know, so dynamic data is great for agility in an application like that.
And being able to very quickly pull together, you know, some interesting stuff. I mean, just the web forms, when you can turn on the dynamic, and like you're saying, where you use the metadata on the model and you can use those attributes to say this is going to fit this kind of a look and feel, and then have that automatically apply all the way through. I mean, that's some powerful stuff.
You're right. And the toughest thing about all of this stuff is that, you know, I've always said when I joined Microsoft in 2001, I had gone out to Microsoft for a private preview of this new stuff that they were working on, and it wasn't even called .NET then. And so when I was convinced to come to work at Microsoft, I did it not because of what .NET looked like then, but what I figured it was going to look like in 5 to 10 years. And we're actually getting to that point. If you look at like the Entity Framework 4.0, the new version of the Entity Framework, it has all kinds of great stuff in it, and I'm loving it. And the toughest thing is that we've been so successful at building frameworks that can evolve rapidly that it's hard for people to figure out, you know, do I learn Entity Framework? Do I pick ASP.NET MVC, or do I work with the new version of web forms? That's the tough part, and that's, you know, those are the questions that I'm hopefully that I'm going to be answering for the next 6 months with my video content.
Hey, that's going to be some great stuff. I'm looking forward to seeing that. Hey, we're getting close to the end here, and I noticed that the MSDN subscription site now has the downloads available.
Woohoo!
Since we started this radio show, they made it live, so you can go out and download Visual Studio 2010. It is now available for download. I think this is some amazing stuff out there.
Awesome. The release version.
Release version. We've gone to production. So this is out there. Get out, check it out, and, you know, stick around. Next week we're going to be coming back, and we've got Michael Klucher coming on, who works on the Windows Phone team. He's been doing a lot with the XNA. He'll be coming on. We've got Christian Shorman coming on, who is the Expression Blend product manager. He'll be talking about what's going on in the Blend world for working with XAML and modern user experience, and how that fits into the phone series as well.
And then we have in May, we've got a couple of people that you may have heard of. Scott Guthrie will be on, and we've got Mark Rusinovich lined up as well as Steve Fox. So,
how'd you get Scott? I can't even get a meeting with Scott anymore.
I guess you got to have some pull, huh?
I guess.
Well, that's our show, folks. We hope you can come back and join us. And if you've got questions, you know, register for the show. You can participate by going out to msdnradio.com and clicking on the registration links. Join us and ask your questions and talk to the experts. Joe, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Mike. My pleasure, and great talking to you again.
And we will talk to you next week. So thank you. And we'll talk to you then.
So that's it for this Monday. Go to msdnradio.com and click the registration link if you want to participate in the next show. Until then, happy coding.